Sukhavati is a massive image or symbol. In a way, it's a meta or a mega symbol with lots of symbols inside it. And it symbolizes a number of things, it seems to me. In a way, it symbolizes the path and the goal, or at least it symbolizes the path from the point of irreversibility onwards towards the goal. So whether your irreversibility is stream entry, or the rising of the bodhicitta, or the turning about in the deepest seat of consciousness, or to go to the Shin school, Japanese Shin school and Shinran, the arising of true faith. That's another form of irreversibility, actually. It's a very interesting one, Shinjin, which has been translated as entrusting, which is lovely, isn't it? Entrusting oneself to Amitabha's vow. It reminds me of something that we had the other day. Came into my mind and it's gone out of my mind again. Entrusting. No, it's gone. But yes, so it's quite interesting that the symbolism of Sukhavati is the symbolism of the irreversible path. It's a symbol of irreversibility in a way. So it's a symbol of a goal, of course, but it's a symbol of the path from the point of irreversibility, and hence the railings. A friend of mine a few weeks ago, after she just read the Shorter Sukhavati Viyuha Sutra, because I recommend doing that in the book, so she'd read it, and she said the railings really grated with her. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like railings in the Pure Land, what's all that about? Well, that's quite interesting. The seven rows of railings and the seven rows of palm trees and so on are the perimeter of the Pure Land. Mm. Yeah, so they're the guardian. That's sort of like the gate. And it's not a gate to keep people out. It's a gate to keep people from falling out. It's not a gate to keep people from coming in. It's a gate to keep people from falling out. The railings prevent you from falling out. And in my flat, I've got this wonderful large painting, reproduction of a painting of the Pure Land. And right down at the bottom, there's this red and gold railing. Yeah. And what it symbolizes is the stage of irreversibility, that once you're in, you can't fall out of the Pure Land again. So the railings represent irreversibility. And just to carry on with that image, actually, then the next thing after the railing in this picture are lotus ponds. And in the lotus ponds, obviously, are lotuses, and on the lotuses are little beings. They've just been reborn into the Pure Land on these lotuses. And there's another lovely bit, actually. There's this platform in the middle of it, and there are these musicians playing music. And there are these little beings, little babies, dancing. They're dancing with joy like this to this music. It's really, really sweet and naive kind of thing. But anyway, getting back to the lotus pond and the beings on the lotuses, in this picture of the Pure Land, it's absolutely teeming with people. And most of them are either looking at you or they're looking sideways on at Amitabha. But there's one being who's just been reborn in the Pure Land on the lotus. Tiny being right at the bottom of the picture. And he or she, it's hard to say whether it's a he or she, has got their back to us. And that is you. Yeah. That is you visualizing the Pure Land. And the interesting thing about that is that the painter hasn't painted them outside on this side of the railing. They painted them on the other side of the railing in the Pure Land. Now, there's a couple of things I want to say about that. One is something that I said earlier, I think, is that when we're visualizing the Pure Land, or when we're listening to the reading, the idea is we're not outside of Sukhavati looking in. We enter into the Pure Land. So when you're imagining yourself in the Pure Land, you're not looking at, you're in it. So it's surrounding you, it's all around you. You know, there are beings and trees and everything behind you and to the left and your right, as well as in front of you. So there's this sense of immersion in the Pure Land. That's very important, I think. And that's because you can only look forwards. That's why, another reason I think why it's important that the element of hearing is there as well, and the element of touch that you've, and the element of smelling the aromas, because they're coming from all over. Yeah, you're immersed in. The other thing about the symbolism of that little being on the other side of the railings is that by imagining the Pure Land, you're becoming irreversible. Yeah, in a way that by imagining the Pure Land, you're imagining yourself as being irreversible for the time that you're doing that. So that's important too. So this is the answer to your question, Dhammamayi. What would make you want to practice in the Pure Land? Well, you don't need any sticks. There are just carrots. There are no sticks in the Pure Land. Well, there probably aren't really carrots either, but there's just the beauty of the spiritual life is enough to make you want to practice. You don't need to suffer as a spur to practice because you're irreversible. Interesting is a bit of a side thing here, which is interesting. I was talking to Sargamati a little while ago about stream entry, and he said, well, of course, in the Abhidharma, you get the whole thing of why does it, you know, once you're a stream entrant, it only takes up to 7 lifetimes to become enlightened. Well, the question is, why does it take so long? Once you're a stream entrant, why can't you just do it really quickly? Because you're reversible now. Well, in the Abhidharma, they've this is what Abhidharma does, isn't it? They rate people as to their laziness or not. So the lazy stream entrants take 7 lifetimes because they're just lazy. And the ones who are really going for it do it in one lifetime, and there's grades of all the others as well, which is really good news for us lazy people. Well, I don't necessarily include you in that, but I'm a really lazy Buddhist. So this is really good news to me that a lazy person can become a stream entrant, and then it takes them 7 whole lifetimes to get there. Well, that suits me fine, but that's a bit of a side issue. Now, what I wanted to talk about today was the fact that because the Pure Land, because Sukhavati is such a big image, that it symbolises so much that it can be misunderstood. So it symbolises the path and it symbolises the goal. Now the path, it symbolises the path mainly through high states of consciousness. It symbolises the path through the jhanas. And the jhanas are expressed through the beautiful imagery. That's what those flowers are, 40 feet of flowers and walking on them. That's an image of jhana. So the whole thing is an image of higher states of consciousness and absorption and the awakened imagination, which is what jhana really is. And it's also an image of awakening, of awakened states of mind. And this is beautifully done in the rivers. You get these rivers, which are, you know, 100 yojanas across and 12 yojanas deep. They're really, really massive rivers. And they're sweet smelling. And they have flowers floating down them, bunches and garlands of flowers floating down them. And you can step into them. And you can step up to your ankle, up to your knees, up to your hips, or to your ears. 4 stages. Yeah, 4 jhanas. Yeah, immersion into the 4 jhanas. You can either get into the first jhana, which is up to your ankles, or the second jhana up to your knees, and so on. It's up to you. You can get into first jhana or 4th jhana. That's up to you. So the symbol of sort of jhana, but also they're murmuring impermanence, peace, no self. They can't murmur suffering, because the word suffering is not heard in Sukhavati. So they murmur impermanence, which is shorthand for all conditioned things are impermanent. They murmur peace, which is shorthand for nirvana alone is peace. And they murmur no self, which is shorthand for all things whatsoever are insubstantial without selfhood. Now that is the bit of wisdom teaching in the whole sutra. And if your mind wandered at that point, you've blown it. You'll have to read the whole sutra again or listen to the whole sutra again to get there. So that is the one little wisdom teaching in the whole thing. And it reminds me of what Bhante once said, that for every ounce of vipassana, you need a ton of samatha. And that's what these sukhavati is. It's a ton of samatha and an ounce of vipassana right in the middle of it. And the point there is that you'll only really receive that vipassana if you're fully immersed in the imagery. Yeah, in other words, if you've got some samatha going. And I was saying to my group this morning that it was unusual for me this morning. The only good thing about having a migraine is afterwards you feel extremely sensitive, and I was really sensitive to it. And I was having preeti near just about all the way through. I was just smiling all the way through. It was marvelous, wonderful. Now, because there's this ton of samatha and only an ounce of vipassana, the Pure Land can get misunderstood. And it is largely misunderstood. The Pure Land, the whole thing of Pure Land is very misunderstood, I think. It's interesting, isn't it, that in the East, I think it's true to say that in China and Japan, that is a really big form of Buddhism for there. Pure Land Buddhism is really, really big in those continents. And I've heard it said that there are more Pure Land Buddhists in the world than any other denomination of Buddhism. Yeah. Yep. In the West, it's almost ignored. It's almost ignored. And why is this? I think it's because it doesn't really sit very well with our modern Western sensibility, which has been contaminated, I would use that word again, but let's say conditioned by materialism. The idea that this is all there is. And so for people like that, the Pure Land looks too much like a religion, and people don't take it seriously. I think that's mainly the way that Western Buddhists see Pure Land Buddhism. They see it as childish and naive. Now, this isn't new. In the 5th or 6th century, there's one of the first ever Pure Land masters, Tan Wan. It was Tan Wan that came up with the idea of self-power and other power, so he's really, really important. But before he became a Pure Land Buddhist, he was actually was a Taoist before that. But before that, he was a Buddhist, and he knew all about the perfection of wisdom. He really knew his stuff. And in those days, China, 5th, 6th century, Pure Land Buddhists were looked down upon by other Buddhists because they said Pure Land Buddhism is childish and naive. And he answered that. He said, some people say that Pure Land Buddhism is childish and naive. Well, what they don't understand is birth in the Pure Land is a no birth. Yeah, perfection of wisdom. Birth in the Pure Land is a no birth. So I remember the Bhikkhu Bodhi's introduction to the Dhammapada is very interesting, because he makes a very good point there. He says that reading the Dhammapada can be a bit confusing because it's the Buddha's teachings in verse taken from all over the Pali Canon, and you don't know who he's speaking to. It's taken out of context, and that can be confusing because sometimes the Buddha is just telling someone how to live well in this life. Yeah, in another, because that's what the person wanted, you know, how do I live well in this life? Well, the Buddha tells him how to live well in this life. And then someone else comes up and says, how do I get reborn as a god? So the Buddha tells the person how they can get reborn as a god. And that's taken out of context and put in the Dhammapada. And then another occasion, someone really wants to gain enlightenment. So the Buddha says, you need to be really careful you don't get reborn as a god. Yeah. So then you get one thing, it says, this is how to get reborn as a god. Then another, he's saying, don't get reborn as a god. So people say, well, what's this? So what Bhikkhu Bodhi says is very interesting. He says that the Buddha was basically talking to three kinds of people, those three kinds that I just mentioned. The kind of people who just want to have a happy life. The kind of people who are concerned about rebirth and they want to make sure they have a good rebirth. And then the kind of people who want to gain enlightenment. And it's all on those levels. So there's these different levels of the Buddha's teaching. And it's exactly the same, of course, with the Pure Land Sutras. Probably, a lot of people in the East, Chinese and Japanese, they see the Pure Land as a heaven. And they want to get reborn in that heaven in their next life. That's fine, if that's what you want to do with it. But it does have this other dimension, and that's the dimension I want to talk about now. And it's the dimension that I call the dimension of mystery. The dimension of mystery in the Pure Land. And it's there, but it's not always very obvious. So it was there in the reading this morning, towards the end of the reading. I don't know if you noticed this anomaly. The Buddha talks about the flowers coming down from the trees. Yeah, carpet of flowers and all that. And he says, when the morning has passed, these flowers disappear completely. And then he said, then it happens again at midday. The flowers come down, and then they go, and then at sunset they come down. And then the first and second watches of the night, all that happens again. So six times, three times in the day and three times in the night, the flowers come down. Immediately after that, he says, nowhere in the Buddha field, Ananda, is there anything that resembles fire, a sun, a moon, planets, constellations, or stars. That means if there's no sun, there's no moon, there's no night and day. Well, he's just said night and day. Yeah. There are no words to designate night and day, he said, except when the Tathagata uses these words in a conventional sense. There's no words to describe night and day because there's no night and day. Yet the flowers come down three times in the night and three times in the day. So this is where I think the mystery of the Pure Land is very often missed, because you miss little things like this. It's a land of mystery. And what is the mystery? You know, when the Buddha was first enlightened, our Buddha, Shakyamuni, when he was first enlightened, he wondered... he thought about teaching, you know the story, and he thought, no, I won't be able to teach because no one will understand it. Because this Dharma that I have attained is deep, deep. The word is Gambhira, same word that is used in the Heart Sutra, Avalokiteshvara, when he meditated deeply, Gambhira. Deep, hard to see, hard to realise. Peaceful, refined, beyond the scope of conjecture or beyond the sphere of reasoning, subtle, to be experienced by the wise. So that the Dharma is deep like that. So what's so deep and hard to understand about the Dharma? Well, there's a lot of it is not that deep and hard to understand. You know, when you teach someone how to do the metta bhavana or the mindfulness of breathing, it's not that deep and subtle and hard to understand. Beyond the sphere of reasoning, it's not. You can teach that, and you can teach people ethics and spiritual friendship and so on, but there's certain part of the Dharma which is deep, hard to see, subtle, and etc. And I've been thinking about this quite a lot recently, because I decided a little while ago that I was going to reflect much more on the three lakshanas. And I began to write about, I find the best way for me to reflect on something is to write about it. So I began to write about the first lakshana, all conditioned things are impermanent. And that, of course, made me think, well, only conditioned things are impermanent. So the condition then is permanent. Oh, and then I began to think about the deathless. And that was funny, because I thought, what is the deathless? And I realized that, you know how... you can be around like for 40 years, like I've been, and you hear about the deathless, you know, from early days, and then you don't take any notice of it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just there, and you think, yeah, the deathless, but you don't really take that on board in some way. And I realised I hadn't really taken it on board, the deathless, that enlightenment is the deathless. And then I began to think, the deathless, what is the deathless? Well, it's not eternal deathless, because... Buddhism is not eternalistic. So then I began to wonder. In fact, I had a mini crisis where I thought, well, maybe I'm not really a Buddhist then, because I don't really believe there's such a thing as the deathless. But it's important. It's really important, I think, that in traditional Buddhism, you get rebirth. And to get reborn again and again is an utter disaster. You don't want that to happen. So you want to get to the deathless, which is not only beyond death, but it's also beyond birth. So what is the deathless? The deathless is amata. Mata is death. Ah is no. So it can be with translation of the deathless or the non-dying. So this is interesting because that sounds a bit like amita, doesn't it? As in amita, Amitabha, Amideva. Amita. So I don't think the words are etymologically connected, but I think it's just a coincidence. It's a really good coincidence because Amitayus is infinite life, which in the text here, because the sutras are not philosophical texts, they're imaginal texts, and in some ways they are naive. They've got Amitayus as being eternal. But what that really means is deathless. So amita and amata are very interesting to look at. So amita, the word amita, is in Sanskrit, it's amrita. And the Buddha took this on from the Vedic tradition. The people practicing the Vedas in those days believed that the point of practicing was to get to immortality, literal immortality, to live forever. So that was the word amrita. So the Buddha took this and he said one of the words that he transformed. He said, yes, amrita, or amrita in Sanskrit, but it's not literally living forever. It's going beyond life and death. It's going beyond life and death. And this is the mystery. This is the mystery. Just before I go into the mystery, back to amrita, the word amrita. I was looking up in the Pali English Dictionary, because you get amrita in Pali as well. And then I decided to look up mitta, because mitta. Mitta is to measure, or measured. So amrita means not measurable, unmeasurable. So we often think of that as being boundless, limitless, big, massive. But it can also mean just something that can't actually be measured, like a person. A person cannot be measured. I've been reading about the Pudgalavadins recently, and they believed in a person, and they believed the Buddha taught the person. It's very, very interesting. And what is the person? The person is inexpressible. A person is inexpressible. You cannot measure a person. It's very interesting. So amrita, you could say, means that which cannot be measured. And I was wondering whether mitta, as in amrita, mitta, perhaps is connected with the Western term meter, yeah, a unit of measurement, a meter. I don't know if it is, but I just wondered if it was. So the Sukhavati represents not just a heavenly realm of jhana, but it also symbolizes the Dharma realm, the realm of the deathless. So I want to talk a little bit about this, the deathless. I came across a sutta recently in the Samyutta Nikaya. Have I got it on this bit here? And it really surprised me. Where have I put it? Oh yeah, right at the top here, yeah. It's the first sutta in the section on the skandhas in the Samyutta Nikaya. And there's this guy, this layman called Nakula Pitusutan. And he's an old man and he's quite infirm. And he's gone to see the Buddha and he's just saying that he's old. And the Buddha gives him a lovely teaching about old age and death. It's really lovely teaching. And a little while later, he's left the Buddha and Shariputra comes along and he sees this man, Nakula Pitusutan. And he says to him, oh, your skin is very clear and golden. I've realised that this whole thing is a bit of a trope in the Pali Canon. You get it quite a bit. He says, your skin is very clear,
complexion.
Thank you. Complexion is very clear, like gold. And this man, his name I can't pronounce, as you know, he said, yeah, I've just been sprinkled by the Blessed One with the deathless ambrosia of a Dharma talk. Isn't that wonderful? Isn't that really wonderful? I have just now been sprinkled or anointed, another translator has anointed, by the Blessed One with the deathless ambrosia of a Dharma talk. So I looked up the Pali, sort of thing I do, and sprinkled is abhisita. And that must be connected with the word abhisheka. Yeah? So abhisheka, you know, from the tantric tradition. And this is why in our ordination we get sprinkled with water, isn't it? That's the abhisheka, yeah? You're becoming anointed, sprinkled with holy water. So this is what this man feels. He's been anointed by the Buddha with amrita, with the deathless, the word is amrita. And the translator here has decided to say the deathless, but also ambrosia, because amrita or amrita is the ambrosia of the gods, the deathless, the immortal. And I thought, how wonderful that phrase is. And I thought, this is a bit, again, by the by, but I'll tell you anyway, because I'm excited by it, that this is the defining experience of discipleship. This is what a disciple is. Someone who feels that they've been sprinkled or anointed with the deathless ambrosia by their teacher. That's what a disciple is. And if you've had that experience, you don't mind that your teacher is imperfect and has faults and has made mistakes and has been unskillful, perhaps. You don't mind that. That doesn't loom large in your imagination. What looms large is that they sprinkled you with the deathless. It's wonderful, isn't it? And I just picked up, a lot of you I've seen are picking up, when you go up to the beams, there's these little Adhisthana programs for the next year. Have you read Sahajaya Tara's?
Yes.
I'm going to write to her and tender this verse, because she describes just this thing. The first lecture she heard by Banji was on the heart switch, and she immediately went into a non-dual awareness. And she said, he'll always be her teacher. A bit moved now. So this is what is happening when we're listening to the sutra. We're being sprinkled, anointed with the deathless. Yeah, that's what's happening. Now, where was I going to go from here? Yeah, so, going back to the mystery. You know those sections from the Udana, those wonderful sections in the Patiligama, the 8th chapter, where the Buddha said, there is an unborn, an unbecome, an unmade, an unfabricated. If there were not this unborn, unbecome, unmade, unfabricated, there would be no escape from the born, the become, the made, the fabricated. But precisely because there is an unborn, an unbecome, an unmade, an unfabricated, escape from the born, etc., is possible. Very, very important, that sutra, I think, very important. It's dualistic. There's an unborn and there's the born. We're in the born and we want to get to the unborn. But the unborn, the unmade, the unbecome, the unfabricated is mysterious. We don't really know what it is. We've got words for it, but we can't really understand it. In the Itivitika, the Buddha goes on to say, the born, the become, the produced, the made, the fabricated, the impermanent, composed of aging and death, a nest of illnesses, perishing, comes from nourishment. The nourishment you get from it. and is unfit for delighting in. Yeah. Then he goes on to say the escape from that is calm, permanent, beyond reasoning, unborn, unproduced, sorrowless, sorrowless, the unstained, the stainless state, the cessation of all dukkha, the stilling of all fabrications, bliss. This is what we're doing when we're listening to the sutra. We're trying to leave the unborn, the nest of illnesses, and we're trying to get to Sukhavati, which is calm, tranquil, permanent, beyond reasoning. It's not a reasonable text. Unborn, unproduced, sorrowless. Of course it's sorrowless. Unstained, the cessation of all dukkha, the stilling of all fabrications, bliss. That's what Sukhavati is. This is what we're doing when we're listening to the text. We're contemplating the goal, yeah, which is beyond our understanding. When I was trying to figure out what the deathless is, and I couldn't, I mentioned it to some people and I took it to my chapter and they were all getting our heads around it. Oh, it's like this, but nobody could, because it's beyond the sphere of reasoning. Yeah, you can't think about the deathless. Well, you can, I tried, but you can't really. It's because it's beyond measurement, beyond categories. You know, it's a bit like with that famous thing where, looking for it now. No, can't find it. You know it anyway, where in the Udana. Oh, the reason I can't find it, I'm on the wrong page, but it's all right, I know it. In the Udana, the Sutta Nipata, final chapter, Upasiva is asking the Buddha a load of questions, and then he says, so, you know, when a Buddha dies, are they gone, snuffed out completely, or do they live on in some way? And the Buddha says, well, you can't say, because a Buddha is beyond all measurement, or beyond all categories. Whatever I say, you'll misunderstand, because you'll see it in those terms. And he's beyond all categorical terms. So that's the mystery. That's the mystery we're contemplating. So I think it's worth bearing that in mind when we're listening to these sutras, because they all very, very much to do with godly realms, beauty and humour as well. But actually, the important thing is that they're also pointing to the deathless, the amata, the deathless state, that which cannot be measured, and that which we cannot understand. Now there is, I looked this up, I found it, Anantamani, I found it. You're going to love this. So this is from the Kevala Sutta, Digha Nikaya. Where do water, earth, fire and wind have no footing? Where are long and short, coarse, fine, fair, foul, name and form brought to an end? In other words, all dualities brought to an end. And the answer to that is this: consciousness that is indefinable, infinite, ananta, luminous all around. Here, water, earth, fire and wind have no footing. Here, long and short, coarse and fine, fair and foul, name and form are all brought to an end. With the cessation of the activity of consciousness, each is here brought to an end. So there's a footnote here about this consciousness that is indefinable. Apparently, according to Tarisaro, it's a word that has never been explained in the Pali canon anywhere. But he says that consciousness is different from the consciousness that we know, one of the five skandhas. It's a completely different kind of consciousness. Lying outside of time and space, it would also not come under the consciousness aggregate, the skandha of consciousness, which covers all consciousness near and far, past, present and future, which means that it cannot be described as permanent or omnipresent, terms that have meaning only within time and space. So consciousness that is indefinable and infinite, Ananta, luminous all around. That begins to sound a bit like Amitabha, doesn't it? So, only a few minutes left. Finally, I just want to say a little bit about this. Now, I don't know how many of you know the Mahavastu. The Mahavastu is a great text. I've had it for many, many years. It's a lovely text. The Mahavastu is in three volumes, and it looks just like a Pali text. You know, it's that dark red colour. It's published by the Pali Text Society, but it's not a Pali text. It's a Sanskrit text, and it's not Theravada. It's the Lokuttaravadins. Lokuttaravadins, who are an offshoot of the Mahasanghikas. Now, the Lokuttara means beyond the world. They believed that the Buddha was beyond the world, you know, above the world. And the they were an offshoot of the Mahasanghikas. Who were the Mahasanghikas? Go back to the survey of Buddhism. You've got the big split in the first council. Is it the first or the second council, the split? Can't remember. Anyway, the split was between the Mahasanghikas and the Staviras, all over a point of controversy about the Vinaya. But the Mahasanghikas were in the majority, hence Maha. They were the biggest Sangha. And the Staviras became the Theravadins. And the Mahasanghikas, that's the beginning of the Mahayana. So when you read the Mahavastu, which is more or less contemporary with the Pali Canon, you get quite a different feel of everything. It's much more like a Mahayana Sutra. In fact, right at the beginning, the 10 Bhumis are described. But anyway, it tells the story. It's supposed to be the Vinaya of the the Lokuttaravadins, but it's not really the Vinaya at all. But then it tells the story of Dipankara, the Buddha. And I'm just going to read you the bit when he gains enlightenment. Then the Bodhisattva Dipankara, with heart composed, purified, cleansed, without blemish, free of lusts, firm and unperturbed, in the last watch of the night, in the first flush of dawn, towards daybreak, awakens to the unsurpassed perfect enlightenment by insight gained in a momentary flash of thought. Very similar to the Udana from the Pali Canon. And then it says, and then this great earth trembled and quaked 6 times. Then a great radiance, immense and sublime, shone forth in the world, and all the intervals between the spheres, regions of blackness lapped in blackness, of gloom lapped in gloom, and of eternal darkness. Sounds really like the Bible, doesn't it? Where the moon and sun, powerful and majestic as they are, with all their brilliance, cannot make their brilliance penetrate. With all their light, cannot exert their light. Even these regions that are black, even these regions become suffused with this radiance. And the beings who are born in those spheres became aware of one another for the first time and cried, "Lo, there are other beings reborn here. Lo, there are other beings reborn here. Lo, there are other beings reborn here." Now, all these beings were, for that moment, for that instant, immersed in bliss. Even those reborn in the great Avicii hell excelled the splendour of the Devas, of Nagas and of Yakshas. All the realms of Mara were eclipsed, rendered lusterless, gloomy and joyless, and wicked Mara was unhappy, discomfited, remorseful, tortured by an inward sting. And a bit later on it says, like the newly risen sun in the sky, Dipankara, the Buddha, fills 100 yojanas with his radiance. Now, I'll read you another one now from the Lalisavistra, which is a Mahayana text. It's a story of the Buddha. O monks, at the very moment that the Bodhisattva attained omniscience, at that very instant, all the sentient beings in all the worlds in the 10 directions experienced great bliss. In all the 10 directions, a great splendour illumined all the world realms, and even the sinister hellish realms, enveloped in darkness, were bathed in light. It trembled. In all directions, the earth shook in 6 ways. It shook, shook hard, shook on all sides. Goes into the 6 ways now. It trembled, trembled hard on all sides. I won't go on to all of it because we're running out of time. But you know what that is? That is the Dharma Niyama. This is the traditional understanding of the Dharma Niyama. The Dharma Niyama comes into play just at the time when the Buddha gains enlightenment and the earth shakes in 6 ways and the whole universe becomes lightened up, yeah, becomes illuminated. This is the Dharma Niyama, yeah. So you can probably see where I'm going here. Carrying on. And all the Buddhas gave their approval to the one who had just become a perfect, complete Buddha. They sent many gifts to the pure one of the Dharma. The 3,000 great thousand of worlds were covered with jewel parasols. From these parasols, networks of light shone forth, illuminating the innumerable and immeasurable regions of the earth in all the 10 directions. So, this happens in an instant, and then it stops. I think what the Pure Land Sutras are doing, they're taking that instant of the Buddha's enlightenment, the Dharma Niyama, where the whole universe is completely transformed into light, and all the beings who are suffering become immersed in bliss, and all the beings who are in darkness, they don't know there are other beings around, so they're isolated, like I was yesterday, isolated in my migraine. It all becomes light again, and they realise there are other beings there, so it's also a great image of togetherness and sangha. That's what happens. That's the Dharma Niyama. Yeah. I think what the Pure Land imagery is, it's like taking that instant and it's making it forever. It's the Dharma Niyama forever. So the Pure Land is the Dharma Niyama. Yeah. And I think that brings together Bhante's understanding of the Dharma Niyama and Buddha Ghosha's Dharma Niyama. Understanding of the Dharma Niyama together, because I know there were one or two of our scholars who are very nitpicking type of people. They say, no, the way Bhante describes the Dharma Niyama is not the Dharma Niyama. This is the Dharma Niyama. Okay, yeah, that's what the tradition says. The Abhidharma says the Dharma Niyama is, but Bhante's reinterpreted it. And I think Bhante's reinterpretation of it goes along very well with this idea that the Pure Land is this Dharma Niyama that happens at the time of the Buddha's awakening, but it happens forever. It's happening all the time. This is the wish that we're, not that it's shaking around all the time, we don't want that to be happening, but the light going off in all different directions. And the other thing is, towards the end of that as well, similar thing with Mara. Mara's army is tossed about like tufts of cotton, and with an arrow, Mara traces pictures on the ground. In another one, I've seen a broken arrow, one of the arrows sort of broken as he's got nothing to do but trace pictures on the ground. He's a sad little geezer because he's been defeated. And one of the interesting things about the Pure Land Sutras is he is not mentioned once. Not mentioned once. Why? Because he's been defeated. He's a nobody now. Yeah. So, finally, I was reading Bhante's thing on confession the other day. You know, the thing he's posted on articles in the Buddhist Center online. And he reminded me of the 4 Maras. Yes. Yeah. Mara is not present in the Pure Land. So there are 4 Maras. Mara, the son of a god, he's gone. He's been defeated. The second one is the Mara of death. Well, he's been defeated. There's no death in the Pure Land. There is death if you want to die. If you are a bodhisattva and you want to die to go and teach beings in other lands, then you can voluntarily die. But if you don't choose that, then that's it. There's no death in the Pure Land. And then the next one is the ma of the defilements, Kilesha Mara. Well, there are no defilements in the Pure Land. So that Mara's not there either. And finally, the Mara of conditioned existence. Well, in a sense, the Pure Land is conditioned, but it's only the Dharma Niyama conditioning. Even the Karma Niyama is not present. So none of the other kind of conditions. It's only the conditioning, which is the flow towards enlightenment.